Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 23rd of November. It is a holiday week. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's a rather dismal, drab, wet Monday. But you know what? It, for most of us, I think, it's a short week. We have Thanksgiving on Thursday and whatever we're going to call Friday. And then, you know, we'll be back to it. But so we have a shortened week, and so that means hump day is tomorrow. So that's not so bad, right, for most of us. And here we go. We're off to the races, and we have a wonderful panel today and just a terrific group of people. So let me introduce them to you. We'll get started. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. Also, we welcome your letters. We always do. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm just doing ducky.
Excellent.
I say ducky because it's raining outside.
Yeah. You need the feathers. What do they call that? The stuff in the feathers that lets the water roll off a duck's back. You know, I was this morning. I was coming into work and I stopped off at an establishment with a drive-through. Okay, I won't tell you the name of the place, but it rhymes with Runken. And I went in for a coffee and a bagel, and the clerk said it'll be $5.54. So I got the $5 out of my wallet. I scrounged in the dashboard. I got 54 cents. I go up to the register, and you know, I proceed with the cars, and there are quite a few cars in front of me. So I wait a few minutes, and I get up to the front. And the woman says, well, it's $5.54, but the woman in front of you paid for your order.
Wow, and you're famous.
It was a random act of kindness. It was just She had no idea. So I won't get into the reasons why. I'm sure that's not the case. But let me just say that it was just a random act of kindness. She said, please just, you know, take it. Have a blessed Thanksgiving. We should all be more thankful. We should all help more. I hope the cat lives, by the way.
Yeah, still live, not to worry.
Okay, good. There were no cats killed in the telling of this story.
No.
So I
Monty Python.
I've been tempted.
Yeah, I would imagine. So I say to the clerk, oh, well, let's keep this thing going. I'll pay for the person behind me, and then we can see how long this chain of kindness and thanksgiving and blessing goes forward. And she says, okay, are you sure? And I said, absolutely. And she said, okay, the guy's bill is $63.52. And I said, I'll catch him next time. So much for that. But what are you going to do?
Funny.
UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. And I have to say, I have been the recipient in the Dunkin' Donuts line of someone before me paying, and I have initiated it before.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a lovely thing.
It feels so great when it happens.
It really does. It really does. And you know, had I had more 20s with me, I would have done it. I feel bad now. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Quite a mouthful, but the nicest man in the world. Jim Henler, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, although I don't know if I feel so nice today because I haven't been doing this pay it forward thing. I'm going to have to start doing that.
It does, you know. It's just like so much of this year has, what's the word, sucked. That when you have something like that, it's just nice. It's lovely, and it did, as Jennifer noted, it makes you feel good. A political columnist, lobbyist, and Miss Pay It Forward, Libby Post. How are you?
I'm just fine. The cat is fine, not to worry.
Okay, taking care of that. That's great. All right, let's get started. Yeah. We have a lot to talk about this morning, and I am anxious to hear. Oh, I forgot our special guest. Dr. Jim Fagan is with us. He is an immunologist. Yeah. He is on the front lines helping. His specialty is in pediatric immunology. He's been with us for many weeks explaining to us and helping us understand what's going on when it comes to COVID and the coronavirus and the pandemic and our response, quote unquote, to that pandemic. And we have a lot to talk to him about, and we welcome him to the program. So good morning, Dr. Fagan. I'm sorry I missed your intro there.
Good morning, Joe. I think I'm going to have to change where I get my coffee, though.
Yeah. It's very nice. People of Troy are lovely. Let me ask you, Doctor, the big question, and so this is going to be a little bit of a shaggy question because I found a bunch of little facts out. But one of the things is that we're most health officials, most government officials are saying, look, for the sake of all of us and for the safety, our safety, for the trying to get this horrible virus under control, it would be a great idea not to have large family gatherings other than your immediate family that you usually dine with. And yet we see that where these orders have been put in place, law enforcement officials, many law enforcement officials say they are not going to enforce them. I don't know how you would, but they're not going to enforce them. And you also see anecdotal and yet actual real data that says that more people are taking to the road this Thanksgiving than anticipated. So maybe that can't be good news. Can you talk just a little bit about why, if you believe that it is, of why it's so important and how you can make the case to people to do what they should do?
Well, I think that to make the case, the first thing you need to do is look at the numbers. You know, the total number of COVID-19 cases in the United States is over 12 million. New cases reported each day is approaching 200,000. Total deaths in this country is now over 250,000. The daily hospitalizations in the United States for COVID-19 is approaching 100,000. And I think it's important to understand the total number of hospital beds that we have in this country is probably a little under a million. And so we're approaching 100,000 hospitalizations. You know, so we're talking about almost 10% of the hospital beds in the United States will be occupied by someone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19. One American is testing positive for COVID-19 every 1.2 seconds, and one American dies every 107 seconds. And these numbers are increasing now. So we know that vaccination is going to start very soon. But the vaccination program will not be an instant fix. There are issues with the different vaccines that maybe we should talk a little bit about. But the important point is that right now and for the next several months, the one tool that we have to fight this pandemic is mitigation. And when you talk about mitigation, first and foremost, we're talking about wearing a face mask. And, you know, it should be a double or triple layer cloth mask and that fits securely over the nose and mouth. We've talked about this. It should be washed regularly. But the masks are not political tools. They are life-saving equipment. But in addition to wearing a mask, we should avoid large events and mass gatherings. And that brings us to Thanksgiving. And I know how important Thanksgiving is to all of us and how much we want to be with our families this day. But I think that it is clear, and the message that should get out there is that the people who attend your Thanksgiving dinner should be those within your family bubble. It's also important to remember, this family bubble has doors on it. You know, there's entrances and exits, and people go in and out. So even the family bubble isn't 100% safe environment. So we want to avoid, you know, the close contact, try to stay 6 feet apart, especially with anyone who is sick or has symptoms, you know, stay home as much as possible. I think, again, it's important to remember that 25% of individuals who have COVID-19 may be completely asymptomatic, so they may not know that they have contracted an infection, and yet they still may be contagious. It's critically important to wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or use an alcohol-based sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. You know, cover your mouth and nose with your elbow or a tissue when you cough or sneeze, and don't forget to throw away the tissues. Avoid touching your nose and mouth. Avoid sharing dishes, glasses, or other household items, especially if you're sick, and that is really important with Thanksgiving coming up. You should clean and disinfect high-touch surfaces such as doorknobs, light switches, electronics, counters, and stay home from work or school if you're sick, and certainly avoid taking public transportation such as taxis and trains and ride shares, you know, if you're sick. So these mitigation issues are critically important. And that's what the recommendation, and I think it really, the success of that is going to depend on individual responsibility.
Now, part of this, of course, I guess, gets into psychology, but why is that so hard for so many? Because I hear people, you know, there was a point where you go in and people were saying, well, I'm not going to wear a mask because of my political beliefs, and I believe it's all hoax and all this stuff. Okay, that's one side of it. But the other is, I know people who are very much pro mask and are, you know, doing all the things they can, and they say, well, yeah, but otherwise my daughter would be alone, or otherwise my son would be alone, or otherwise my mom would be alone, and they're making exceptions. I as you said, I understand it, but I don't know how you appeal to people like that and say, okay, but you can get through maybe this one time.
Well, this is an extremely contagious virus. It's one of the most infectious viral pathogens that we know of. It's much more contagious than influenza. You know, if one person is sick, even if they're asymptomatic, they could spread the virus. And they could spread the virus to 7, 8, you know, 9 people. So, again, I think we all understand the importance of Thanksgiving and the importance of family. You know, it sort of defines us, and there, of course, we want to be with the ones that we love for this wonderful holiday. But you don't have to give up mitigation to have Thanksgiving. Now, it's hard to eat with a face mask, admittedly, but you can space people out. You can add an extra table. You can sort of make some distance within family members, especially if they're not within your family bubble. So there's still things that can be done. You got to be careful about not sharing utensils. I think pay attention. You know, keep this, you know, this in mind as you're enjoying your family dinner.
Jim, I have a question real fast. Thermometers, you know, when you go somewhere, they'll take your temperature. Now, I have a question for you. I'll be honest with you. I don't do it more than 5, 6, 10 times a day.
right.
So my question is, how accurate is this in diagnosing the illness?
You know, I think it's foolish to think that a fever is going to define COVID-19. I mean, people get febrile for a whole bunch of different reasons, and one of them is that they have an infection. Being febrile doesn't necessarily mean that you have an infection, and it certainly doesn't mean that you have COVID-19. But it's it's a biomarker. You know, it's something that at least something that we can do and pay attention to. I mean, if someone has a temperature of over 100.3 Fahrenheit, that's how you define temperature, and really should be a central temperature. But the thermometers, even the ones that you don't touch the skin, are pretty accurate now. So if someone has a fever, you know, that's a warning sign that something is going on. And that
can you have it without it?
I'm sorry?
Can you have it without?
Oh,
can you
absolutely.
Have the
oh, yeah.
That's the point.
You do not. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You absolutely do not have to have a fever to have COVID-19 and to be contagious. And when we say asymptomatic, we're talking about afebrile, not having any symptoms, no sore throat, no cough, no symptoms whatsoever. 25% of people with this virus are asymptomatic and are contagious. Yes. So not having a fever does not mean that you do not have the virus.
We have a bunch of questions from our audience, and Dr. Fagan will be with us into the next segment as well. Panelists, if you have any questions for Dr. Fagan, let us know, and we'll do those as soon as we come back from break. Susan writes and says, Dr. Fagan, have you heard about the vaccine at a University of Pittsburgh where it requires no refrigeration and no syringes, but it's administered via a skin patch?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Okay.
Nope.
Then Jim brings up the very good idea, or the very good question, rather, of there's the Moderna, Pfizer, and AstraZeneca vaccines that are moving forward. Jim asked the question, should you take more than one, and which one will be the one that would be best? Who makes that decision as to which one is best?
That's a great question, and the answer is we don't know yet, because none of the vaccines have yet to be approved. There are a bunch of vaccines that are out there. The one that we first heard about was the Pfizer vaccine and then the Moderna vaccine. Both of those are messenger RNA vaccines, and I think it's sort of important to understand what that means. Messenger RNA vaccines are completely unique vaccines. They've never been used before. We've never had approval of a messenger RNA vaccine. The vaccines that we've used in the past, or some of them are live viral vaccines, some of them are attenuated viral vaccines, some of them just use the protein of the infectious agent. But we've never had a messenger RNA vaccine. So messenger RNA vaccines are definitely unique, and I think it's a brilliant way to actually put together a vaccine. Messenger RNA vaccine, it is protein from the virus. It's the viral RNA that gets incorporated into the human cell and begins to instruct the human cell to produce viral protein. The viral protein that's produced is the spike protein. That's that spike that the virus uses to gain entrance into human cell. And we make antibodies against that and prevent the virus from invading the human host cell.
All right.
So it's a brilliant way of doing that.
We have we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we have a ton of letters from people who have very specific, really good questions for you. So we'll do that. I think the panel has some questions for you. They'll think of those, and we'll go to those when we come back as well. Dr. Jim Fagan is with us, along with Alan and Jennifer and Jim and Libby, and we'll get to everybody and your questions, which of course we'll take at panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Henler, and Libby Post. We also have a very special guest, Dr. Jim Fagan, who's an immunologist. His specialty is in pediatric immunology, and he is joining us to talk about all things COVID and coronavirus and the pandemic. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. I will say two things. One is, a programming note, we have learned that Governor Andrew Cuomo will be giving a briefing and an update on the coronavirus pandemic at 11:30 this morning. So we'll go to that live. I believe it's in New York City. So we'll go to that live when that happens at the bottom of the 11 o'clock hour. And then, Doctor, let me just ask this question before we get into all of the questions that our panel has and our listeners have. If I'm not call me Captain Obvious here, but the big issue with this is we've seen this after Memorial Day, we've seen this after 4th of July, we've seen this after Labor Day, we've seen this after Halloween. We see these spikes that come of just social times, following social times where people get together. So you already have this very increased state I believe yesterday it was 3.1 million cases of coronavirus just since the 1st of November, which is startling. So the big concern here is that we're going to see an even more of a spike, after post-Thanksgiving. And then, oh, by the way, you have all holiday, whatever, get-togethers pre-holiday, and then the actual holidays, which will also increase those as well. That's the concern, right?
That's the major concern. You know, remember, we're approaching 200,000 new cases a day. You know, every five days you get another million in the United States. And there is, as you pointed out, Joe, there's no question, after every major holiday, we've seen spikes. There's no mystery in terms of what's going on here. Again, it's one of the most contagious viruses we've ever seen. And so this is to be expected. 25% are asymptomatic. You know, there's no way of knowing that somebody is sick or contagious. And we're going to see this explode after Thanksgiving if people are not careful. You know, and by the way, we're approaching, again, we're almost 10% of the hospital beds in this country are occupied by patients with COVID-19. What's going to happen 2 weeks from now, a month from now, 2 months from now? You know, the medical infrastructure is so overly stressed right now. I'm not, you know, I have major concerns in terms of what's going to happen in the next, you know, number of weeks.
Are you personally being impacted by the most recent surge?
The area where I live in Long Island, I think people tend to be very responsible. You wouldn't, it's rare you see anyone walking around without a face mask. We're very, very careful in terms of, taking care of kids and families. We have set up protocols that are, very labor intensive but these are things that we all have to do. And I think that the area where I am practicing, again, I would hope that we don't see a major surge. I'm sure we will see an increase in numbers. But right now, you know, we're sort of doing okay, certainly in comparison to where we were several months ago and to where many parts of the country are, you know, right now. Again, it has to do with the responsibility of each and every one of us to do the right thing. It isn't what we're being told. It's what we're actually doing that matters. I do expect to see, maybe people are leaving New York, going to other parts of the country. But hopefully, there will be, mitigation practices will be, maintained and we'll be able to keep this under control.
Let's go to questions from the panel members, if anyone has one. Jim, do you have one to go? Maybe Jim's not there.
I got a question.
All right, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, Jim's there. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the Opal app was having trouble unmuting.
It happens.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is we have all these different vaccines with very different treatment, very different handling protocols.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of it looks like they're all going to be hitting the approval process around the same time. Do you know sort of how much is political and how much is medical in the decisions about how these will be, which ones will be distributed, the cost factors, and all those kind of things?
Yeah, well, I hope it's all medical, Jim. I mean, there are, as you point out, there are a number of different vaccines. The Pfizer, Moderna vaccines, or the messenger RNA vaccines, which we talked a little bit about. The other one that just came out, I think yesterday, was AstraZeneca's vaccine. That's not a messenger RNA vaccine. That's a replication defective live vector vaccine, which means that it's a live vaccine, but it's been mutated so the virus itself cannot be, it's a live virus, I should say, but the virus has been mutated so that it can't replicate or divide, so it cannot be infectious. We've had lots of other live vector vaccines in the past. And then there are a couple of other what we call technology platforms in terms of vaccine development. But it's not crystal clear, right? First of all, no vaccine has been authorized. No vaccine has been given emergency use authorization yet. That's coming up, and hopefully within the next week or so. And so the data has to be thoroughly examined. But there are issues, obviously, with the different vaccines. The major issue with the Pfizer vaccine is the fact that it has to be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius, which means that it requires special refrigeration units that most doctor's offices do not have. And so there will have to be vaccination centers that are set up throughout the country. And, these could be pharmacies. It could be health clinics, or it could be, tented areas that they just established to give the vaccines. But, most doctor's offices do not have the Revco or the special refrigeration units that will be required to store that vaccine. So that's an issue with the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna vaccine doesn't require that level of refrigeration, so that would be easier in terms of facilitating vaccine transportation and use. There's a difference apparently in terms of efficacy, which certainly has to be looked at. The Pfizer vaccine is now reported to be 95% effective, which is wonderful. I mean, that's great. So I think that we're going to have to look at all of these data. I mean, we're striving to achieve through vaccination, herd immunity, and we've talked about this a number of times on the show. In order to establish herd immunity, roughly 70% of the entire population of the United States would need to be immune to COVID-19. If the Pfizer vaccine is 95% effective, that means that about 240 million Americans, roughly 75% of the entire population would have to be vaccinated in order to reach that herd immunity. Both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have to be given in two separate doses, about 3 to 4 weeks apart. So that's obviously another issue. But look, I'm sure that all of these obstacles will be addressed and overcome. But, the notion that a vaccine will be made available and that within 1 to 2 months we'll be able to resume our normal lives is ill-conceived. Mm. And I think, again, mitigation efforts, especially mask wearing, will need to remain in place for the next several months. So, but we have to, look at the data see what happens. There have been a number of concerns about, the vaccine development that I've heard, passed along to me, and I'm sure my colleagues are the same. We've all heard the name Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed is a partnership of the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Defense, and the private sector. I think the name Operation Warp Speed sort of speaks to the need to get the vaccine available in record time. And that, of course, raises some concerns that maybe the efficacy and safety issues might be compromised in order to get a timely vaccine out. I don't think that's going to be the case, Jim. I think the FDA officials have reaffirmed that vaccine decisions will be made based on scientific data and that there will be no compromises with respect to evidence standards. These safety issues will have to be subjected to the same time-tested mechanisms for evaluating and regulating vaccines that have been established by the FDA and the CDC for many, many years. There is a process in place. Emergency use authorization, will be made by the FDA Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. Decisions regarding vaccines should also be reviewed by there's another organization called the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, which is a panel of non-governmental scientists and physicians and other experts. And their job is to review evidence for vaccine candidates and make recommendations. So this should really enhance the transparency and the legitimacy of the FDA's decision. Then there are issues of deployment. Who's going to get the vaccine? And that's where the CDC has an advisory committee on immunization practices, which is a panel of advisors that has the primary, it's been the primary United States body responsible for establishing guidelines for vaccine use. And so I think that there are, there are processes in place which will really look and make sure that this is done the correct way and that it's all based on science. I mean, we need to rely on science. There is absolutely no place for politics or partisanship when it comes to vaccine development.
Thanks.
Alan.
Jim, I know that, of course, you have a second hat. Your primary hat is as a pediatrician. How are we doing on schools? How are we doing on schools? I mean, you know, this is
Alan,
such a tough one.
It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. It is so painful for these kids not to experience, you know, the school environment, not to be going to school every day, being with their friends, the social development, the academic development. I mean, it just breaks my heart to see this. Also impacts on the economy, because when the kids are not in school, they're home. Somebody's got to watch them. Somebody's got to oversee what they're doing. You know, obviously, you can't go off to work and let your kid sit down by the computer screen all day. New York has that 3%, rule that they put in place. And I certainly understand, 3% meaning that 3% positivity of the COVID-19 tests that are done. If 3% or more turn out to be positive, that's an indication of spread through the community. And that was the number that Governor Cuomo established statewide to determine whether or not schools need to be closed. I mean, the issue, it's just so painful, to see that. You know, there are other issues, though, which I would sort of look at, and how come schools are closed but bars are open? The school closing, I think, the other thing is that schools, certainly, when you look at the number of active cases in the school, it's very low. It's running about, probably a third of what it is in the community. And so, in a sense, you could look at that and say it's a safe place to be. But there are issues, I think, that need to be addressed within school. I mean, there's concern that the teachers have, not just all about the kids. Of course, it's about our kids, but it's also, teachers have a say in this, and staff, must have a say in this, and some of the teaching staff may have underlying conditions which render them susceptible to problems and complications with COVID-19, and so it's very complex and very complicated, and we just have to struggle through this.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have more questions. Dr. Fagan, you're good for another 10 minutes or so?
Yes, sure.
Okay. You hold tight. We'll be right back, and we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Dr. Jim Fagan is with us, immunologist, talking about the pandemic. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Henler, and Libby Post also with us. And we have letters. So I'm hoping, Jennifer or Libby, do you have a question? We'll do that, and then we'll go to a listener lightning round with Dr. Fagan.
I have two questions.
Okay.
One of them is, from what I gather so far, the vaccines are focused on people that are 18 and older.
Correct.
So what's the holdup for younger people? And then also, when can we expect that a vaccine will be cleared for them or for their use?
Yeah. I mean, this is typical of the way that medications and vaccines are developed. Obviously, you have to go through a number of clinical trials. There's phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. Phase 3 is the large clinical trial that looks for, safety and efficacy. And it's really the safety issue. There's no question about efficacy. I mean, if it's effective for adults, the overwhelming likelihood that it will be effective for children. There may be an issue of kids under 6 months of age in terms of their immune responsiveness. But so the efficacy is not going to be the issue. It's going to be a safety issue. And, traditionally, medications and vaccines have first focused on adults, unless it's a specific pediatric illness that we're trying to deal with, for obvious ethical reasons. But as a pediatrician, that's always posed a little bit of a problem for me. It's so frustrating to see, the vaccine that I know as a pediatric immunologist will be very effective, not being allowed to be used in kids because they haven't had the studies yet. But to answer your question, the studies are ongoing now. They have not been you know, published yet, but they're ongoing, looking at kids, I think, down to 12. And then I think there will be rapid fire looking at the younger, you know, kids, probably down to 6 months. Honestly, I have no doubt that these vaccines will be, if they're proven to be safe for adults, will have the same safety record for children. But, you know, it needs to be looked at. I think it's important. I wouldn't, certainly as a pediatrician, I wouldn't want to cut that corner, that's for sure. But the studies are ongoing now, and they're going to be massive because we obviously want to protect, you know, the younger generation. Now, having, you know, if we could establish herd immunity levels in, you know, in adolescents and adults, that obviously is going to have a major impact on the safety of the younger kids, because they will be less likely that they will come in contact with someone who is infectious with COVID-19. But, you know, I think your point is well taken. We need, you know, we need to really push forward very quickly, you know, with a vaccine that will be able to be administered to young children.
Let's go to our listener lightning round. We have just till the top of the hour, so we'll get in as many of these as we possibly can. Susan writes, Dr. Fagan, please review when tests are reliable. 2 or 3 days after symptoms? How many days before symptoms? If asymptomatic and happen to take a test, when is it reliable?
Well, the test is reliable if it comes out positive, no matter whether you are having symptoms or not. A positive test, you know, no test is 100% accurate, and there still can be, you know, false negatives. But if it's a true positive test, that's reliable. That means that you are infectious. And that's what the diagnostic, you know, if they're diagnostic, if the diagnostic test is different than the antibody test. The antibody test means you have been infected at some point in the past. But a positive diagnostic test means you are currently infected, which means, you know, you have to isolate. You know, that means isolation for at least a week. You know, it means that you can't have symptoms for a couple of days, but you have to be isolated for at least a week from the point where your test becomes positive. You know, if the other part of the question was?
I think the other part of the question, well, let me just go to antibody tests and ask about that part, because we have another listener who was wondering that we heard a lot about antibody tests at the beginning of coronavirus, and saying that if you had the antibody test to see if you've already had coronavirus and might therefore have immunity. And Joan is saying she hasn't heard a lot about these tests since the spring. Are people still getting them, and are they useful?
Yeah, the antibody tests are extremely useful, because what the antibody, a positive antibody test, means that you have seen COVID-19. Remember, this is a novel virus, so you're not going to have sort of positive antibodies from years ago. This is, if you have positive antibodies to COVID-19, that means that you have been infected in the past several months at some point. Now, the real question is, what does that mean? You've heard me say on the show the antibody test is just the tip of the iceberg with regard to immune responsiveness. You know, it's much, much more going on than just the production of antibodies. We measure antibodies. It's relatively easy for us to measure antibodies, so it's a great way to determine if someone has been exposed to and infected with COVID-19. But it's really the cell-mediated immune responses, the lymphocytes, the T cells, the B cells. You know, I'm not going to get into that right now, but that's sort of what's really driving the immune response to COVID-19, and it's that cell-mediated immune response that actually is very, very important for the antibody response is part of that. The real issue is how long are we immune to COVID-19? And the honest answer is we really don't know yet. Yeah, my gut feeling is that the immunity is probably going to be relatively long-lasting. And we do hear reports of people getting COVID-19 for a second or a third time, and I have some questions about those cases. To tell you the truth, I would, you know, if someone really got COVID-19 two or three times, I would, as an immunologist, I would worry about their immune system. You know,
right.
Perhaps, you know, we're dealing with someone who is, you know, relatively immune deficient and incapable of mounting a good immune response. But, you know, we have to wait and see. We're hoping that, you know, the immune response to COVID-19, you know, will be long lasting, and it's possible it could be lifelong. you know, and that also, you know, sort of brings us to how long will the immunity from the immunization last? You know, and that's something that, again, you know, time will tell. You know, we're hoping that it will be a very solid, robust, long-lasting immune response to this infection.
So we have two more questions and that we can get to, and I'm going to kind of morph them together. Dave wants to know if accepting a Thanksgiving food plate from family who are careful, he notes, should I wait a day or two to eat it? And then that also goes to Robin's question of how seriously should you be about wiping down your mail and groceries and such surfaces as that?
Yeah, in terms of the Thanksgiving dinner, no, I think that if you're, you know, if you do this the smart way, you're having Thanksgiving meal, you know, with people in your family bubble, as we call it, and everyone is, you know, been as safe as they can and engaged in good mitigation practices and being careful. And it might add an element of security if, you know, people got tested, you know, a day or two before Thanksgiving. That would be wonderful if everybody who came to your dinner, you know, knew that right. They were negative. But you know, I think that if you can do that, I think you can have, you know, a normal meal with your family.
But I think his was if your big sister drops off a plate of food for you, is it okay to eat it? And yeah, right? I mean, if they take cautions, it would be the same thing.
Well, it
right?
depends on your sister.
Yeah, well, sure. Absolutely. It always does, doesn't it? And then as far as mail and groceries?
Yeah, you know, mail, I used to sort of wipe everything down. I don't think it's necessary to do that. I think it's a little bit overboard. I think it's been shown that the virus does not stay on material like that for any length of time. Certainly if your mail has been sitting there for an hour or two, I don't think you have to wipe your mail down. And we no longer, you know, wipe our groceries down.
All right. Dr. Fagan, I thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on the program. We'll check in with you again probably after the holiday and see how things are going. But I do appreciate your time. Have a beautiful Thanksgiving, and we really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Joe, and a wonderful Thanksgiving to all of you.
Thank you very much. Bye. All right. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Henler, and Libby Post are all here. I promise we will be back with them and talk about many other issues right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Quick programming note that Governor Cuomo will be speaking on the pandemic coming up at 11:30 this morning. Governor Andrew Cuomo here in New York will be doing that at 11:30 from New York City, and we will be carrying that live as soon as it becomes available. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Henler, and Libby Post join us this morning, and we are thrilled to have them. We've been talking all about the coronavirus over the last hour, so we're going to move on to other topics and talk about other stuff. So let us begin with the president-elect. President-elect Biden is expected to make his first cabinet picks on Tuesday, according to top aides. Names are already coming out. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Meanwhile, the president-elect also is pushing for a quick stimulus deal, preparing for renewed recession. Economists warn that lawmakers must pass aid now as a renewed coronavirus surge chills consumer spending and business activity. And all of this happens as the current occupant of the White House has yet to acknowledge that there will be an incoming administration and is still fighting the results. So with all of that, we go to Alan, and then we'll work our way around the room. And I promise Libby will come to you first, because I don't believe I've heard your voice, only your cat. Go ahead.
Great. I passed to Libby.
Okay, Libby, you're off. Go ahead.
Well, I'm here, and I'm sorry about my cat, but she has this thing, so I'm not sure. It's not health-related. It's just, you know, she's 15.
Yeah, okay.
Well, be that as it may.
All right.
You know, that's the way it goes. Be that as it may. I mean, you know, I think that Biden is sort of in a bind here. We do need to pump money into the economy. We do need a stimulus package. The Democrats, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Schumer want the larger package. If Biden says, okay, we'll go for the smaller package now, with the hopes of taking the Senate in Georgia and that doesn't happen, you're going to see the schism that's already starting to play out stupidly in the Democratic Party get even worse. Where, see, he's a sellout. See, you know, I'm already reading stuff about how some of his cabinet picks are putting Fox in a hen house and all this sort of stuff. And people just need to calm down. But we do need to bring some money into the economy. The key is this. We have to make sure there's a bailout for the state. You know, it's just that simple. And, you know, if they don't do the bailout for the state, which means a larger package. And, you know, in terms of McConnell, he's like cutting his nose to spite his face in the long run. You know, we need to have these bailouts for the states. Otherwise, large states that drive the economy, like California and New York, are going to default. And then we'll all be in a depression that we had never expected nor really know how to deal with. So they've got to do something, and McConnell's got to find a backbone or get beyond his own power, love of power, his affair with power, and do what's right for the American people.
Libby, while we're at it, could I just ask you about your sense of, because I've been seeing, watching the TV night, day, on this, on these electors, four of whom in Michigan, right, are saying,
yeah.
Two say, do the Democrats say sure. One Republican says no, but assuming both Republicans go south, is it your understanding that it doesn't matter? I saw one election lawyer, a very prominent Republican election lawyer, says it means nothing. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think it was the Secretary of State who said it's too late. You can't take that vote back. You can't go back and relitigate this. Once these four people voted to certify the election, that was it. And, you know, and they've done whatever recounts they were going to do in Michigan. They've done their due diligence. All the court cases have been thrown out that Giuliani and his band of idiots have put forth. And so, you know, all of that, even Chris Christie is saying it's becoming a national embarrassment. And if Christie is willing to buck the president on this, you know, there are plenty of Republicans who are grumbling and saying enough already. Let's get on with this because we have a job to do. And their seats may be vulnerable in the future. So I don't think Michigan can reverse itself. And even if it does, Biden still has the vote, still has the Electoral College votes.
Yes, but it would be scary for what it would mean for other states that have yet to certify.
Yes. It would be scary, but the fact of the matter is each state has its own rules and regs for the certification, and you know you're not gonna get all four of these states to turn around. Even Brian Kemp has said Georgia's gone for Biden. Let's move on. And I don't think Michigan is going to change. I don't think Nevada's going to change. I don't think Arizona's going to change. I mean, yeah, it is scary because of all the crap that they've been trying to pull the wool over America's eyes to say that this vote isn't valid. We all know it is. We all know that Biden has won. Well, not all of us, because there are plenty of the Trump people who still believe everything that he says. But any rational thinking person, let me put it to you that way, who actually reads the news, who actually follows what's going on, who actually can think on their own with some critical thinking skills, knows that Biden won the election, Republican and Democrat.
Jennifer Burns.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is this squabbling over this, because it is becoming, it's proving over and over and over again that we have had one of the most secure elections that we've had in probably decades. So all of these lawsuits that keep getting, you know, kicked back and refused are actually proving how secure our election was. And that is being lost in all of this chaotic stuff that's going on and all of this media throw up and all of these this craziness. Biden has won, and really the holdup to all of this now is Emily Murphy with the, you know, the General Services Admission. It is proven. It was safe. It is done. Biden has won. say it or assert it, whatever you have to do, and then let's begin this transition. That's what it is. So the rest of it is just a distraction.
I'm getting a little frustrated by hearing the media come on and say, well, the Republicans are starting to crack, the wall of support is cracking, and then they mention, you know, the three people who are speaking up, and it's like Lisa Murkowski and, you know, Mitt Romney and Chris Christie. I mean, that's hardly, to me, a major domino effect. Jim, what do you make of it all?
Well, I was going to say, Joe, I don't know if you saw last night, Carl Bernstein reported that actually named 23 senators who in private and on the record, or at least people they talked to went on the record, saying that they wish Trump would move on from this. And then he went on to say, but, you know, they're still not willing to do it in public because right. of the pressure from McConnell. And I think once again, we find McConnell is just this roadblock to everything. And you know, it's kind of insane that between the power of the president and the power of this one senator, we're seeing such gridlock in this country. Hopefully, assuming we get past all this, we'll get somewhere where people can start thinking about how to make sure this doesn't happen again in the future, or else we'll be doing this every 4 years.
Right. Well, and that is,
you know,
go ahead, Alan.
He said optimistically.
You know, there's a famous story about Stalin. He was lying there. He's dead. They're all standing around him. And all of a sudden, his toe twitches. You understand the issue here. I think a lot of those Republican senators are afraid his toe is Trump's toe is going to twitch and he's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or figure out a way, right? So
right.
the I'm struck also, I think Libby made this point about the president's lawsuits and his, I believe it's referred to as his elite strike force team, has one less member. Sidney Powell has been disavowed from the group, even though she was on at the bizarro press conference that Rudy Giuliani had last week. She was introduced as being a lead in this fight. Oh my God, to be a fly on the wall for the conversation where it was determined that she was too crazy for them.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I thought they would have loved what she said. You know, Venezuela, dead presidents, George Soros. It's right out of the Trumpian playbook, but I guess it was a little too much.
So
they had to vote someone off the island.
That's right. Somebody had to go. Yeah, I thought of that exact analogy, Jim. You're absolutely right. You have to vote somebody off the island. So my question is for the group, if this, as it seems to be, if states start to certify, we'll see what happens in Michigan and the other states, as they start to certify the election, and it becomes, you know, inevitable, which it already seems like it's been inevitable, but even more inevitable, when does, and Alan, I'm interested in your insight on this, when does McConnell say, okay, enough, wait, we got to move on?
Tough one. You know, it's hard to get inside of McConnell's head, Joe. He is a guy who plays it strictly by the self-survival rules. I think he's disgusting. But in all honesty, if he thinks there's anything in it for him, he might do it. But I don't. But remember, he's got to herd those cats in the sorry for the reference there, gang. But he's got to herd those. Got to herd those cats in the Senate. And he's got some real stinkers in there. So, you know, I can't get inside his head. I think basically he's been a rat all along, and I think he's going to stay a rat.
I think, for what it's worth, Alan, and I agree with you, he's got to have his eyes on Georgia. And he's making his decisions based on whatever, you know, his advisors are telling him is going to play in Georgia. And the second they tell him that, you know, making Biden, you know, admitting Biden will get you Georgia versus it won't, I think that's the moment he's going to flip.
And having
why should he?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, why
should
he?
Well, what I'm saying is if they say go this way and that'll increase our chances of winning Georgia, that's what he'll do. I think he's just totally focused on staying the head of the Senate, and those two races are so critical to that.
Uh-huh. What's because I am curious, you know, just what's going to happen as more and more states start to certify, and if the legal challenges continue. I think there's two major ones left, and if they they'll keep on going, but the hope is that one of them will go to the Supreme Court. The best case was for Michigan. If that doesn't happen, I just don't, you know, what more do you do? Have you exhausted every avenue?
How would you like to be those two, Joe, those two Supreme Court justices he just put on the court, talking to their families about what they're going to do? I mean, it has got to be a conundrum for them. And by the way, he really wants it to get to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and his aides are saying that that's the goal. But you know, how does it get there? What does it accomplish? And is there any legal precedent, or are they going to be like every other court and just dismiss it? So that leads us to this issue, which is the president using his last days. So while the right hand has all the lawsuits in it and is saying that we're not giving up and we're fighting and I won, the left hand is doing a lot, according to the New York Times, going to extraordinary lengths to try to prevent Mr. Biden from rolling back the president's legacy. This article from Michael Shear, who writes, voters have decided that President-elect Joe Biden should guide the country through the next 4 years, but on issues of war, the environment, criminal justice, trade, the economy, and more, President Trump and top administration officials are doing what they can to make changing direction more difficult. Mr. Trump has spent the last 2 weeks hunkered down in the White House, raging about a stolen election and refusing to accept the reality of his loss. But in other ways, he is acting as if he knows he will be departing soon and showing none of the deference that presidents traditionally give their successors in their final days in office. During the past 4 years, Mr. Trump has not spent much time thinking about policy, but he has shown a penchant for striking back at his adversaries. And with his encouragement, top officials are racing against the clock to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, secure oil drilling leases in Alaska, punish China, carry out executions, and thwart any plans Mr. Biden might have to reestablish the Iran nuclear deal. In some cases, like the executions and the oil leases, Mr. Trump's government plans to act just days or even hours before Mr. Biden is inaugurated on January 20th. I guess this should not surprise us, Alan, and yet it will make it difficult.
No, and to be fair, Democrats have done some of those things themselves in trying to thwart an incoming regressive administration. Nevertheless, not to this degree. But it's not surprising that he's doing it. And, you know, I have such great faith in Joe Biden. I really think he's a good man and a bright man. And I think he's much, much smarter than I am. And it's that faith that I have in him that's keeping me going here. Every time I hear, you know, two electors may try to get it into the House of Representatives or this or that, I think they know what they're doing.
Libby?
I agree with Alan, and I want you to take that to heart, Alan. I think Joe Biden does know what he's doing. He knows how this government works, I think, more than just about anybody else in that place, because he's been there for so long. I also think he's got some very deep-rooted relationships with people in the Senate, and ultimately he will prevail. Ultimately, we will see good things happening, and, you know, what we need to make sure of is the idea that once the Attorney General is appointed, that they go back to Obama-era perspectives and work about cracking down on domestic terrorism, cracking down on the Klan, cracking down on militias, because that's the real threat to our democracy. We can rail all we want about Donald Trump, and he is their trigger and their dog whistle. But when Trump is gone, they will continue. And we have to make sure these people are not a threat to our democracy, because that's what I see as the biggest threat. Armed militias, you know, like the guys who wanted to kidnap, ultimately rape and kill the governor of Michigan. That's what we're going to see more of, and that's what needs to be cracked down upon.
Meanwhile, just a quick note before we go to Jim and Jennifer, there were announcements over the weekend, not official, but have come from the campaign that have been verified, that Joe Biden has chosen Anthony Blinken as the, he was formerly the number two in the State Department in the Obama administration, that he has now been tapped as Secretary of State. And President-elect Biden is also expected to appoint Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as Ambassador to the UN. So three top spots that will be announced by the campaign officially either today or tomorrow. Jennifer.
I echo everything that Libby is saying. You know, it's so difficult, I think, right now for people with the pandemic looming the way that it is, for them to trust the government in general. And we see not only, you know, it's hard to trust the government, but it's also hard to figure out what exactly is going on. And then everyday ordinary life is being, let's say, curtailed in a safe way for us to get through this pandemic. And, you know, so I think it's difficult right now when it comes to paying attention to politics. I also think that Trump is pushing through, or trying to, and McConnell is helping him fill as many positions as possible in, say, the Federal Elections Commission, the Federal Reserve Board, you know, federal judiciary pieces and communication centers, in a way that McConnell thinks will aid him even if Georgia is lost. And that behind-the-scenes stuff is what I think people really need to pay attention to, because they will be the eyes and the ears, or continued friends, of this Trumpian movement in the government after Biden comes into office.
Jim.
Yeah, I have to agree with Jen on that one. You know, I've been looking at these people Biden is mentioning, and, you know, rather than picking well-known people with key constituents, he's going for competence. He's going for people who know the space, who've worked with him and with other administrations. I can't tell you, as sort of a sometimes insider, just how good it feels to know that there's going to be competent people at the top of these agencies. But on the other hand, the rot that has been put in by the Trump administration goes so deep that it's really scary to know where this is going to, you know, how long it's going to take them to clean it out. And they're going to need the Senate to be approving people. But if they can pull that off, if Libby's right, then I think we're going to start to see government that works again. And I just hope it can really pay off, because we need it. There's so many threats that have been ignored, and so many terrible things have been done by this administration at places like DHS and Department of Defense, that,
well,
you know, just getting good people back at the top will be such a difference.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll do our last 15 minutes together and go over the remaining issues that we have to talk about today. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Welcome back to Card Sharks. Good morning. Welcome back to the program and to our roundtable panel. It's a delight to have you all with us. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Jim Hendler, and Libby Post. And we welcome you, your letters, panel at WAMC.org. All right. Let's see. One more topic I want to get to, and then we'll finish up with some letters that we have left over. This I thought was an interesting story from The Washington Post, that Trump's ban on transgender troops hurt the military, according to former service surgeons general. President Trump's order banning many transgender people from serving has eroded the military's ability to fight and win wars by narrowing its recruiting pool and lowering morale among transgender troops exempt from the policy, according to former top military physicians in a study that was just released. Defense Department regulations implemented April 12, 2019, prohibit anyone with gender dysphoria from enlisting, but allow transgender service members who were serving before them to remain in uniform. Trump and military officials have argued that barring transgender people from serving would improve readiness and strengthen unit cohesion, but a study published by the Palm Center, a research institute that studies LGBTQ personnel issues in the military, said the opposite has occurred. The transgender ban has harmed military readiness across the board. That's what happens when the military needlessly discriminates against people who are qualified to serve. That according to Alan Steinman, a former U.S. Coast Guard Director of Health and Safety and retired Rear Admiral of the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. Libby, let me begin with you. I know we've talked about this issue in the past, so what do you make of, I don't think there's any surprise in this study, but then how do you make it better?
Well, first of all, this wasn't President Trump's order. I mean, it was. But this is Mike Pence's order, honestly. You know, Pence is the one with the virulent anti-LGBT agenda. Trump, you know, Trump will say, I've done more for the gays, just like I've done more for the blacks, I've done more for anybody. But the fact of the matter is, this is really a Mike Pence move right from the start. And it has undermined our ability to recruit good people, and it really shouldn't matter what someone's gender identity is, what their sexual orientation is, what color their skin is. If they want to serve, they should be allowed to serve. As we get younger and younger people, I mean, you know, the military is made up mostly of younger people. And we've seen that the younger cohort doesn't care about marriage equality. They think it's, well, what's wrong with it? And so we're seeing the same thing with the younger cohort being not indoctrinated, but seeing transgender folks as being just part of the norm. They're just regular people who you know, don't feel comfortable in their own bodies, and they go through the brave acts of going through this transition and living their life honestly and the way they want to. But whether or not that means somebody's not ready to serve is absurd. You know, they said the same thing about people of color, that it would disrupt unit harmony, you know, and readiness. They said the same thing about gays in the military. It's all of it is just bunk. It's just, it's hatred masquerading as policy. That's all it is.
And these are still brave people who want to fight for our country.
You know, I mean, I'm not one to, like, go rah-rah about anybody's right to serve in the military because, you know, it just leads to war and all the rest of that. But for those who do want to, they should be allowed to. And the fact of the matter is that this president has left us more vulnerable to attack and more vulnerable in the hot spots of the world, especially what he's doing withdrawing troops from Afghanistan just to put Joe Biden in a bind, than any other president in our history. And so we need as many people who want to serve to be able to serve.
By the way, I disagree with you, Libby, on one thing. Not on the very important stuff you're talking about. I wouldn't be that quick to let Trump off the hook because of Mike Pence.
I know. Yes, I get that.
Mike Pence is so deferential to this president that he wouldn't be doing any of it without Trump's tacit approval.
But I don't think Trump even thought about this. I think it was Pence who brought this to the table, and Pence who brought all the anti-LGBT stuff to the table.
He's not the president. The president is the ultimate authority.
I get that. Anthony Blinken, do you know who his dad was, Alan?
Go ahead. He was a friend of... I don't.
Now his dad was the former chair of the SUNY Board of Trustees when I came here in 78, 79.
Well, that's right. The way I know that is that when I worked for Senator Orenstein, I ran something called the Advisory Committee to the Democrats in the New York State Senate, and he was on it. Papa was on it.
Yeah. So, but that's just between me and Alan. Sorry.
Okay. that would be Donald Blinken, yes?
Yeah. Right, Don Blinken, the dad.
All right.
To put it mildly, he had a lot of money.
Jim. I heard you enter the
frame. No, I don't think so. But I was just going to say, I actually think Libby is right on this one, that when it comes to these horrible justices who've been put in, when it comes to a lot of the LGBT and et cetera, I think Pence has been delegated to do it, and Trump is just signing the paper, essentially. Yes, so he has to approve it, but I don't think he's paying attention. I don't think he could care.
Because he has Pence has such a long record of doing this in Indiana. Yeah.
And with all the respect to you, Jim, how do you know? In other words, we don't know.
This is the rumors inside. But,
Jennifer?
You know.
Well, you know, I think that it's definitely a Pence-led movement. And I think it's also trying to build, this sounds very sinister of me to say, but I think it's trying to build a coalition at the local levels against transgender people in general. Because we look at, you know, the violence and the attacks and murder of transgender people in American society, which we often don't hear about. It doesn't make the news a lot, but it is rampant. And so I think there's a movement to really build an overall, I don't know the word I want to use here for this, but just attack, almost like a wiping out of transgender people. I know that sounds very morbid, but it's not just in the military. Mm-hmm. That's the one we're seeing, but it's on the local level, and we don't hear about it. And I think Pence is all about this. I've been thinking a lot about Mike Pence lately, and it hasn't been pleasant, I have to say. he's so behind the scenes sneaky, in my opinion. And I've been trying to look into like where he is really located. You know, he doesn't own a house in Indiana, which I find odd. I've been trying to figure out where he actually owns a home because you would think he would. And it says a lot to me, and I'm not sure what to make of it yet, that I can't find it. Like, he doesn't. So what was he planning, or what was his future projection for himself in politics? Was he thinking he was going to run for president in 2024, and now there's a kink in that, so he's staying quiet? I mean, what is he doing? And I think this is part of building a larger network for his own political future, this transgender movement.
Now, that's an interesting point about the future. That's a very important point because, you know, up to now, everybody's assumed, okay, Donald does his two terms and then, you know, Pence has a shot. However, the Trumps aren't happy with that. They keep talking about at least one daughter becoming the president of the United States and looking at the way that that's going to work. And now, of course, Trump is going around, his people are saying 2024. So that lets Pence out the door.
But
the other thing that Pence's rhetoric does, and what Jennifer was saying, that trying to deny the existence of transgender people and make them disappear. Well, they've been doing that because when the hate crime statistics came out, and HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, added their information to all of this, you know, the amount of transgender women of color who have been killed this year is astronomical, and it's going to just continue. You know, transgender people are targeted for death in this country, partly because of the rhetoric, partly because of the ignorance. But when you put the two together, it's just deadly.
Do you think, obviously, under a Biden administration, which seems to be much more interested in assisting the LGBTQ community, that even on something we started off this discussion of talking about service to the country. That how hard, how easy is that to turn around and reverse?
Well, it's an executive order. All it was an executive order. He's going to have a stack of executive orders on January 20th when he walks back into the Oval Office to sign, and this is going to be one of them.
We are.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, and I think that it's important now we look at holding people accountable, including the president and others, for their actions right now. You know, people should be prosecuted. People should be charged with any of the crimes and actions, whether they're government officials or not, for supporting this and causing the death and harm of people in America. I think that needs to be a part of the story in the future, not letting people off the hook for following any of this kind of rhetoric by Trump or actions led by him or Pence and others.
Great points. We're going to hold it there this morning. We're out of time. I want to thank our wonderful panel, Alan Chartek, of course. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Jennifer Burns, Jim Henler, Libby Potts, and, of course, Dr. Jim Fagan, who joined us in the first hour. Thank you all very much. We'll be back right after this.